Welcome to the February podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pynchon. The February issue is on the topic of hypothalamic hamartomas. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. Harold Ricate of the Barrow Neurological Institute in Phoenix, Arizona, speaks with Dr. Jeffrey Rosenfeld of Monash University in Melbourne, Australia. They discuss Dr. Rosenfeld's article, The Evolution of Treatment for Hypothalamic Hamartoma, A Personal Odyssey. The article appears in this month's issue of Neurosurgical Focus.
This is Harold Ricate. I am the chairman of pediatric neurosurgery at the Barrow Neurologic Institute in Phoenix. But within the next month, I will be the new director of the Chiari Institute on Long Island. And I'm the special editor for the February issue of Neurosurgical Focus, concentrating on the rare but interesting problem of hypothalamic hamartomas. With me is Professor Jeffrey Rosenfeld from Melbourne, Australia, who is the stimulus for all of the work that's been accomplished in expanding our knowledge of hypothalamic hamartomas over the last 20 years. Good afternoon or morning, whatever it is there, Jeffrey.
Hi, Hal. Probably attribute too much of the gains in knowledge to me alone, Hal. There are a lot of people involved, not just me.
I'm sure. But you're the one that I know. You have written an article on the attempt to treat surgically hypothalamic hamartomas as a personal odyssey, and that was the thing that I was most interested in our previous discussions and for the issue of Neurosurgical Focus, and I'd like to go into that a little in detail with you, if that's okay.
Sure, be delighted.
Now, once every decade or so, something new happens which allows us to think differently about and make great strides. The one pediatric neurosurgical example of that would be Dr. Fred Epstein discovering that holochord intrinsic low-grade tumors could be resected in total with good quality outcomes. It seems to me that the hypothalamic hamartoma story is the same, and that my personal fear of treating them because there was no visual cue and no way to know when to stop, no way to know how to prevent injury, I think you deserve a tremendous amount of credit for that discovery. Now, what was it that made you believe that you could safely remove hypothalamic hamartomas that were intrinsic in the hypothalamus? And what did you do to prepare yourself for this surgical intervention?
Well, I think, Hal, that the first patients we started seeing down in Melbourne with this condition had devastating epilepsy, and they were not responding to medical therapy. And they were in a desperate situation, really, and we could see that, certainly from the literature, that if they went untreated, they would become intellectually disabled in a major way and would have severe intractable epilepsy, often with an epileptic encephalopathy, which means that their brain really was in a total epileptic storm virtually all the time. And it's no wonder that they couldn't learn anything new. Their behavior was erratic. They had severe temper tantrums, presumably because these seizures were rapidly spreading to the mesial temporal structures, the amygdala in particular, and into the hypothalamus itself, so that their aggression and rage was just extraordinary. They were attacking their parents and their siblings, and the families became dysfunctional and just couldn't cope with it. I mean, you can imagine the devastation for the family of having a child with this degree of disability. And as well as that, these kids often had precocious puberty. They were very difficult to manage, and attempts to remove these lesions before the mid-90s were often leading to severe complications that we'd seen reported in the literature, like hemiplegias and even deaths, and I don't think all the deaths were even being reported in the literature. And I don't think the patients were often being referred, because firstly because the neurosurgeons, including myself, and obviously yourself were very reluctant to operate in this part of the brain and remove something from the hypothalamus. And also the devastating complications had been reported from surgery, and people had been trying to remove these things from, as I say, from below, which means via an open subtemporal or transylvian approach, and the imaging wasn't that great before we had high-resolution MR, so you couldn't really define the anatomy very well. When we started seeing the MR pictures coming through of these lesions, we could see the ones that I saw initially looked like they were exophytic, and in other words, attached to the hypothalamus rather than being an intrinsic part of the hypothalamus itself. And I thought once we'd tried to remove one of these things from below, we looked at the post-operative images, and we found that, well, most of the lesion was still there. It was like the tip, we'd removed the tip of the iceberg, but we could still see the lesion beautifully in the third ventricle attached to the hypothalamus. So the next case that came along, as I reported in this article in Neurosurgical Focus, we decided to actually try and remove the component that was within the third ventricle, and that could really only be done via a transcolosal approach. It couldn't be attacked from below because the angles were just wrong. Couldn't get up high enough into the third ventricle. It's not like a craniopharyngioma where you can draw the capsule down below the level of the hypothalamus. Here, you've got a fixed tumor-like lesion, which could only be really attacked from above. And once we started doing that on the next few cases, and I reported the first five with Simon Harvey, who also deserves a lot of credit for this as well, because he was the head of he still is the head of neurology and was the head of the comprehensive epilepsy program at the Children's Hospital in Melbourne. And we both sort of worked on this together, he from a neurological standpoint, looking at the spread of the seizures and the semiology and clinical picture, and myself working on the surgical side. Together we developed this idea that we should try and remove or disconnect the lesion as much as possible from the hypothalamus. And when we started doing the surgery, we found that the lesion was actually separate from the hypothalamus itself. It could be defined what was hematoma and what was hypothalamus in terms of the colour and the texture of the hematoma compared with the normal hypothalamus. We didn't know that until we started doing it, that would be the case, but it clearly was the case, and you could define a sort of a plane, and not a very clear plane, but at least there was a plane where you could say, look, this is probably the end of the hematoma and the beginning of the hypothalamus. And the critical thing to the operation at that time that we found, and I think it still holds today, is that the lesion always attaches to the mammillary body. And the mammillary body is probably the main route of spread, but it probably also directly spreads into the rest of the hypothalamus as well. But certainly if you can disconnect it from those mammillary bodies, easier if it's on one side than both, you've got a good shot at dampening down the epilepsy very significantly. I'm sorry to go on for so long, but that's sort of how it developed.
I agree with you that you can tell when you come to the interface with the mammillary body, there is a color difference between the hematoma and the mammillary body. But if you're talking about the wall of the hypothalamus, I'm not sure that I agree that you can tell. I would say that my advice to neurosurgeons in general is that you couldn't do this without neuronavigation at this point.
No, I agree with that.
You shouldn't
I
do
definitely
that without,
agree with that.
Without it.
Hell, just one other point on the separation of the hematoma. There's a key point that I've found as well, which I didn't report in this particular article in Neurosurgical Focus, but it is mentioned in some of my technical reports, where you can actually, once you get to the back end of the hematoma and you're resecting it with a cavitron or with your beautiful little resecting instrument endoscopically, you come to the perforators coming off the tip of the basilar. Once you reach perforators, obviously we don't want to go any further, and that's really the back limit of where I resect these lesions. So you've got that to go on as well. Although it's pretty frightening, obviously, coming up against these deep perforators, and you've got to be very careful, and very careful about using diathermy and bipolar coagulation in this region, because the spread of heat, I think, can damage these very fine perforators and lead to hemiparesis and other neurological complications. So be very, for those surgeons listening, be very wary of using a lot of coagulation in this region when you're actually separating it. They don't bleed very much. You don't really have to use much in the way of coagulation, I found.
I completely agree with you on that. I also think that that if you see the perforators, you've gone too far. I do everything in my power now to maintain the peel surface between the bottom of the hamartoma and the interpeduncular cistern. We did have, most of them were occult, but in our postoperative imaging studies, we did have several patients who had small thalamic infarcts from perforators. So I think
you can identify
the peel surface, and that's really a great place to stop.
Yeah, that's inferiorly, but when you're actually in the parenchyma posteriorly, you can sometimes come across these perforators as they've actually pierced the peel surface, and they're actually ascending in the parenchyma. Mm. And I agree with you. You don't want to actually see them if you can possibly avoid it. But if you do, if you chance upon them, please don't go any further. That's it. That's it.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is important, when you do an interfornicial transcolosal approach, you get a much bigger field of view than you do with a endoscope, which is one of the limitations of endoscopy, the size of the lesion. But sometimes they're both within the third ventricle and attached below the hypothalamus, so therefore not approachable. Now, what are your goals of surgery if they sort of wrap around in the bottom, below the hypothalamus?
Well, I think the goal is to try and disconnect the lesion from, that is to separate the lesion from the walls of the hypothalamus as much as you possibly can. The advantage you have with the open approach is that you can see both sides of the third ventricle, and particularly in a bilateral lesion, I think you've got a much greater scope for getting more of the lesion disconnected than you have through an endoscope. I'd be interested in your comment on that. Once the lesion goes out laterally, it's a bit like a pituitary tumor. Once it goes out far laterally, you're not going to get it through a midline approach from above, and or in the pituitary's case, from below. And sometimes you just have to do an open pituitary to get that very lateral part out, although these extended skull-base approaches are changing that. But getting back to the hamartoma, if it's lateral, on the underside of the hypothalamus rather than the midline, well, you're not going to be able to disconnect it from above either endoscopically or open, unless the angle is a very nice angle with the endoscope, I would have thought. But you've had more experience with that, Helen. I'll be interested in your comment. But I think if there is this lateral exophytic pedunculated component extending down below the hypothalamus, and it is lateral, I emphasize lateral, then you're going to need to think about an open approach via an orbitozygomatic approach rather than the midline. You may have to do both, and I think, you know, we certainly have reported from the Barrow with Fez Ifan and yourself the combination of both, which then was extended in your series. You don't have to do that very often, but I think sometimes to get that complete disconnection, you do. But you might be surprised that if you disconnect as much as you can from above, even though you've got that remaining component, you may still get such an improvement in the epilepsy that you don't actually have to go on and do the second stage.
You know, I think that I hate to disagree with my mentor, but one of the things that I have found as we've had our first patients are now 8 years out, or almost 8 years out, and yours are almost 15. They're just like almost all other epilepsy surgery, there's a late failure rate. The more I see of these patients, the more I think that we should try very hard to get a complete removal or a complete disconnection. And I would say that for tumors over 1.5 cubic centimeters or centimeters in diameter, most of them now are being planned for stage procedures. I would say that we get much lower complication if we do two operations, one from above and one from below, on the large lesions. And okay. I would love to hear your comments on that.
Well, I think it's a hard call with some of these patients to put them through another major operation with certainly some risks in there, particularly to the optic tracts and the other structures sitting in that area, the third nerve, the perforators, and even the peduncle itself. I mean, these are tricky operations, and I would say for a group that's very experienced in this sort of surgery, yes, by all means. But for the groups that are not so experienced, I wouldn't necessarily sort of rush into these multiple staged operations. I would certainly like to wait and see how they go after a very major procedure from above. We're talking about the very big bilateral lesions.
Right, we're talking
about
the giant.
We're not just talking about the routine run-of-the-mill lesion.
No.
And these can be incredibly challenging. And I think that as the experience of the group develops, then the group gets more adventurous, and I think that's what's happened in your case, and you deserve a lot of credit for that, because you've pushed the envelope to the limit here with some of these very difficult lesions. But remember that we also have radiosurgery as a backup as well, and we need to think about how we can integrate the radiosurgery into the surgical program as well, as it were.
No, I completely agree. One of the things which does not seem to be mentioned as much as it deserves in the literature, I mean, all of us have put commentary onto it, but I don't think that it's been studied in a structured way, is an extraordinary ability to change the quality of these kids' lives from a point of view of their behavior. I had a recent case in which, while she was still in Phoenix, the mother came in tears the first time she'd ever been able to take her daughter to the mall without her breaking things and having a tantrum. And maybe even more than the seizures, and probably they are related, you're right, but probably even more than the seizures, the change in the behavior, the increasing docility and normalcy of the children is the thing that I've been most struck by, and it's the hardest thing to quantify, you know.
I agree with you, Hal, and to see a child that's never been able to read letters and learn anything, going from that to actually starting to read stories and understand them and sit down with their parents and concentrate, because these kids couldn't possibly concentrate, a lot of them, on anything. And then to have them calm and not attacking anyone and not screaming and ranting, it's just an amazing transformation. And until you actually experience it yourself and you see the joy in the parents, it's just really a joy to behold for the neurosurgeon. It's one of the most satisfying parts of neurosurgery I've ever been involved in, to really transform the life of the child and the family in this major way. It's very hard to convey that in a written article, and it's very hard to quantify it, as you say, but it's just so dramatic, and it's so gratifying to see it happen from something that you can do as a surgeon. I think the pinnacle of my achievement in neurosurgery is to change the lives of these devastated children and their families. It's a very big privilege for us.
Absolutely. It makes Christmas so wonderful, because I get all these Christmas cards from people, and it's just wonderful.
Yeah.
I would like to throw in a little bit of a plug for the Hope for Hypothalamic Hamartoma.org website. They are putting together a lot that is for the families regarding what research is available, what the techniques are available, and I think that the internet has made a huge difference in providing information for these families that have led to the good results that we've been able to get. And I completely agree with you that this has been a great privilege.
The other thing, Hal, if I may mention it, is the actual anterior interfornicial approach. If I may say just a few words about that, because when I started doing this, I was doing it through a fairly wide transcolosal approach, similar to what had been described in the literature over many years. And people said to me, look, you're doing a transcolosal approach, big deal. I mean, this has been done for years. What's so unique about it? Well, what was unique about it was I tried to modify the operation so that we would do as little interference to the fornices as possible. And if you do an extensile approach through the roof of the third ventricle, you are going to upset both fornices, however gentle you are. Yes, you could try and do some sort of subfornicial unilateral approach if you wanted to, but you're not going to get a great exposure and you're still going to end up injuring the fornices. And I tried to target this approach to a more anterior angle between the columns of the fornices and get right to the front end of the third ventricle with the opening. But paradoxically, it's a very small opening, but then it gives you a panoramic view of the front end of the floor of the third ventricle. If you can get into that space, that interfornicial space, and go down between the columns right at the level or even in front of the foramina of Munro to get that angle, that's what I described as being different to what I believe had been described previously. And I think that's where people get it wrong, that about this approach, that we're trying to minimize retraction and damage to the fornices by doing this more anterior approach. And I think we should always bear in mind the cognitive outcomes of these patients. And it's okay when you've got a very devastated young child, if there is a little bit of memory disturbance, or maybe more than a little bit, if you can stop all of the other things that are going wrong, I think you've done the child a great service. They're never going to be a genius in terms of their learning ability if they've lost some short-term memory function, but at least they're functioning better than what they were. However, some of the older patients that we've seen, the teenagers and even the adults with this condition, who've had a milder form of epilepsy throughout their life, who have a good memory and have achieved at school, and some have even entered university, they've still got their seizures, they've still got problems, and they want something done about it. Here, if you start trying to do a transcolosal approach where there is a risk to short-term memory of about, shall we say, 10%, maybe up, maybe a bit higher than that, maybe a bit lower, that can be a devastating problem for a young person to go through their life with that short-term memory problem, which can be permanent. So in those cases, I've sort of come round to the view that maybe we should be looking at radiosurgery as a first line, and I'll be interested in your comment on that. Having said that, I must recall a case of radiosurgery where there was a small intrahypothalamic lesion which had a beautifully targeted radiosurgery lesion that you could see on the post-op MR, and the epilepsy wasn't changed one little bit. So radiosurgery is not necessarily the answer to all problems, but certainly I'm trying to minimize risk to the fornices and to memory, and I can't say even the anterior interfornicial approach is going to protect the fornices completely, and there's still a risk to memory that approach. So I just caution people about it, and that they need to think about the cognitive outcomes as well.
Well, I think that the first step, my first comment about that would be that we have neuropsych testing on every one of the patients that we can get neuropsych testing on.
In terms
of their cognitive ability. And it is definite that there is not a single one of these patients, not even one, that presents with seizures that doesn't have a pre-existing short-term memory deficit.
Yeah.
Now, it's less than 10% of increase in the short-term memory deficits if you look at after 6 months. There's a fairly high number of them, whether they be done with endoscope or whether they be done by the interfornicial approach, that have an initial short-term memory deficit. But at six months, it's very, very rare. And I agree with you that I know of only maybe one patient whose short-term memory deficit has led to even any decrease in the quality of their life. But the problem with the approach that you have, which I love and was my all my first experiences, is that there is probably an age limitation in real adults, 30-year-olds and over. The leaves of the septum pallidum are usually not separable, and you end up with having to go through, make a different way, either go through the foramen of Monroe or behind the venous angle or something like that to get in, because sometimes you just can't open that up.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree. But I still try, but it's tough.
Yeah. And from the radiosurgery point of view, there are limitations on both size and position. If your size is more than a centimeter in diameter, I don't know that you're going to get a reasonable result, number one. And number two, if it pushes or seems to distort the optic mechanism, either the optic radiations or the chiasm, you need to get 17 gray radiosurgery in order to get a predictably good result. And since the optic radiations and optic chiasm will only allow 8, if they're posterior and small, I think they're wonderful for radiosurgery. But if they're anterior and large, then I think they need to be debulked first, at least, and try to take them away from the optic mechanism before you give a radiosurgery.
Oh, I think that's very good advice, Hal. Very good advice.
Well, I will always remember your trip to Phoenix, and I really appreciate your mentorship.
Thank you, Hal, and thanks for inviting me to do this podcast. It's been great talking to you.
This concludes our podcast for the February issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Please join us for the March issue, when the topic will be ossification of the posterior longitudinal ligament. For more information on how to submit your research to Neurosurgical Focus, or to see a list of upcoming topics, please visit thejns.org and click on Neurosurgical Focus. Comments on this podcast can be sent to jnspodcast@thejns.org. Thank you.